I'm Jason Lopez for PodTech News. I'm with Craig Barrett, chairman of Intel, who spoke at the Education Writers Association meeting held in New Orleans in the first week of June 2006. Thank you for being on the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Let's talk about your involvement in this issue of education in the U.S. This has been something that you've been heralding for quite a while. What got you interested in talking about education in the United States and U.S. competitiveness?
Well, we're really interested in math and science education predominantly. We're an engineering science-based company. We employ lots of engineers and scientists who are interested from the education of our workforce, but we also produce products that go into the marketplace that people use in engineering and science and computers, so we're interested in the general public being knowledgeable about this as well. So that's kind of the intel to the public involvement. If you look at the international aspect, I speak more from the heart of a U.S. citizen with children and grandchildren here, and I want the U.S. economy to be as competitive as possible. And if it's increasingly a technology-based economy that we deal with, then the knowledge of our workforce of math and science and engineering is increasingly important.
Well, maybe this seems like a simplistic question, but why does the U.S. need to be competitive when it seems like many companies are very borderless, including Intel?
Well, the answer is somewhat of a patriotic answer. I mean, if you're a U.S. citizen, you want your economy to be as successful as possible. You want your standard of living to be as high as possible. That only happens if you have an educated workforce that contributes more than other countries, more than the workforce of other countries. So from that standpoint, if technology is a driving force for the productivity of your economy, knowledge of technology is important. Intel can exist very well as an international company with a very small U.S. workforce. We happen to have 60% of our workforce in the U.S. We do about 90% of our research and development in the U.S. So we're still very U.S.-centric. That could change in the future, but speaking as a U.S. citizen, again, with grandchildren in the U.S., I want the U.S. economy to be as successful as possible. Therefore, I want these high-paying jobs to be in the U.S.
One of the potential pitfalls of the flat Earth view is that in some ways culture is kind of glossed over. I'm talking about cultural attributes of various regions and countries, but you take a country like Japan. How does the U.S. remain competitive when you have Team Japan, for example?
The great competitive advantage of the United States over the last several decades has been its heterogeneity, both in its workforce, its people, its ideas, its embracing the concept of, a destructive creation. That is, you kill yesterday's products to create tomorrow's products, and you create always new products. You have this technology treadmill going forward. I think the United States, because of its diversity, its heterogeneity, probably has an advantage over some other countries, certainly in the entrepreneurship category. The U.S. has been the leading entrepreneurial country in the world for decades. We can continue to build on that strength, but the only way we can do it is with a well-educated workforce. So we have to, education is the foundation, it's the building block for everything that goes above it. If we have a good education, use our entrepreneurial spirit, our diversity on top of that, then we can become competitive. But without a good educational framework, nothing else works.
One thing that you alluded to in your speech was the fact that the United States dominated the world economically when you were in school. There are probably a lot of reasons for that. Perhaps one of them may not have been that the U.S. was necessarily competitive as much as the U.S. was able to get by World War I, World War II, without having a lot of physical damage to the infrastructure, and was a lender to the rest of the world after those wars. And it gets very complex, obviously. What I'm wondering is it possible that the United States can never dominate again without some of those factors that led to the first round of domination, so to speak, in the 20th century? Can we actually achieve that economic superiority that you alluded to?
It's probably unreasonable to expect the United States to have a grossly disproportionate share of the U.S. wealth, just as it's unlikely that we'll have a grossly disproportionate share of the number of educated engineers. The United States has been successful in the past with its educated workforce. Sometimes that educated workforce has come from other countries. The end of World War II, we imported a large number of Western European people. There was a brain drain from Western Europe in the 60s and 70s. The U.S. was the preferred place to come to work. In the 80s and 90s, a lot of Asians came to the U.S., preferred place to become educated and to stay and work. So we've drawn from other societies much of our life, but the foundation of all that has been highly educated people, whether they were U.S. nationals or foreign nationals, choosing to come to work in the United States and creating wealth, creating new ideas, new products in the U.S. What we need to continue to do to have a high standard of living is that same sort of creation of ideas, products, companies here in the U.S. It takes educated people to do that. Whether we can dominate to the degree we used to, I think that's a moot question. Our challenge going forward is, how do we continue to build on our standard of living? How do we continue to have a high standard of living, a highly productive economy? Maybe not from a totally dominant standpoint, but at least increasing the standard of living in the U.S. while the rest of the world increases its standard of living as well. You can't do that without a highly educated workforce.
When you look at the past, in terms of how we got here, it's very complex. And then during Katrina, we saw on our television sets the results of some of that complexity, and many people were very befuddled as to how this could even have happened. Do we need to go back and kind of rip apart some of the undercurrents of our society in order to make some of the changes that you're talking about, or can we just make them regardless of the complexity of our culture?
There's no question that the United States is a very complex society with its racial, ethnic, cultural mix. Sometimes that's a great strength for the United States. I think the most important thing we can do is, rather than try to tear down the past and rebuild from scratch, is accept the realities of competition going forward and then adjust our expectation levels of what it takes to compete. You know, there's nowhere in the United States, with one or two exceptions, that we don't recognize competition in the world. I mean, if you're going to play baseball or basketball or participate in track and field or play soccer in the United States, you recognize what competition is. If you're going to build semiconductors in the United States, you recognize competition. If you're going to build 747s or passenger-carrying airplanes, you recognize competition. One area where we have not done a good job recognizing competition is in education. We've been very inward-focused. You know, we compare Tallahassee with Jacksonville. We compare Fort Worth with Dallas. We compare San Francisco with Los Angeles. We don't compare San Francisco with Singapore or Munich or Moscow or Beijing or Bangalore. And increasingly, as this world flattens out and competition exists between cultures and societies and countries and individuals around the world, then you have to compare yourself to the best. You can't exist in a vacuum. And unfortunately today, in this area of education, we're very inwardly focused. We don't recognize that it's an international competition, as we do in every other one of our activities. So, you know, it's time to wake up and smell the coffee and say, I'm going to compete in this space.
In that film, Stand and Deliver, we saw kids from the barrio in Los Angeles learning math and passing the state exam. And it goes to show that anybody can do this if they apply themselves and if you have teachers that can provide that magic in the schoolroom. What happens next? Do we actually start seeing this happen, not just in the rich white schools, you know, around the country, but in L.A., in the barrio, in New Orleans?
Well, two comments. One is, you know, if you go to Mexico and you look at the education system there, if you happen to walk around Monterey Tech, major university campuses in Mexico and that school system, I mean, you see excellently trained Mexican nationals. If you go to India, you see the same thing. You go to China, you see the same thing. You go to Malaysia, the Philippines, you go to Ukraine, you go to Czech Republic, wherever you go, you see that it's possible for young children anywhere to be challenged and to successfully move forward. What we have to do in the U.S. is recognize that our expectation levels are just not high enough. That our kids are capable of performing at much higher levels than we give them credit for. And you can see that in instances where you have good teachers, even in relatively poor school districts and poor schools, they can bring out the best in kids. We just have to get that spread around. That's a disease that we have to, it's an infectious disease we need to spread throughout the United States. It's raising this expectation level, recognizing that kids can perform far higher than we give them credit for, and not dumbing down examinations, you know, not having these exit exams for high schools, which demand the kids know eighth grade mathematics to graduate from high school, or ninth grade English to graduate from high school. You know, why aren't we saying, if you go through 12 years of school, your 12th year, you should know the 12th grade material, not the eighth grade material. Sometimes we just set our expectations way too low.
Intel has involved itself in the rebuilding of New Orleans schools, especially when it comes to IT infrastructure. During your keynote, you mentioned, though, that the magic in the classroom starts with the teacher. As the chairman of Intel, your words probably have a resounding effect on what happens in your company and how you're going to approach the rebuilding of schools. And I imagine it's not going to be just insert some servers and make some connections and then walk out the door.
No, we're firm believers that information technology is a great tool, but it is a tool. And teachers can use tools to make education exciting and interesting, and they can use it to inspire children to learn more. So as we work here in New Orleans and elsewhere to try to bring information technology in the classroom, it's not as the answer, it's as a tool which can be effectively used. And by the way, to be effectively used, it's the teacher who needs to know how to use the tool. The teacher has to be familiar with the capability. So we can talk about putting IT infrastructure in place, but frankly, getting the teacher trained to effectively use that tool is probably more important than the IT infrastructure. There's a different way to look at this, which is U.S. kids don't do very well in math and science compared to their international counterparts. Yet, kids in the United States have more IT infrastructure in their schools than anybody in the world. So if it was just IT infrastructure, our kids ought to be doing better in math and science than anybody in the world. They're not. So it's not the computer that's magic in the classroom. It's the teacher that's magic. And getting the right infrastructure, but then getting the teacher trained, is absolutely the key issue.
Well, Craig Barrett has been my guest on this podcast. And Craig, thank you so much. You obviously don't have to be here talking about this. You could probably make a bigger impact on Intel's fortunes down the road by going to CES or something like that. So it's obvious that there's a lot here that is a labor of love for you, even though some of it will affect Intel down the road and it will affect the U.S. A lot of this certainly is coming from your heart and something that you really believe in.
There's no more important thing for the United States than educating our next generation of citizens. And from a U.S. citizen perspective, the most important thing I can do is, in fact, help this process. And talking to the people here who can spread this word and can write about it and can put their opinions and help shape the opinions of other people. So it is probably the most important thing for our society is educating our young people. And so talking about it is a labor of love. It's not a chore.
Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Pleasure to be with you.